good evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming.
Something for everyone, a comedy tonight.
Tonight we'll hear from a few comedians who tie back to KVCR in one way or another. We'll hear from Bobcat Goldthwait, occasionally a guest on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and from John Pate, often a guest on American Parlor Songbook, heard on KVCR Sunday afternoons at 4. We're going to start with a way you can still catch stand-up and maintain social distancing. Add to that, when's the last time you were at the drive-in? This involves comedian Maz Gibrani, heard also on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. We'll hear from Gibrani in just about 5 minutes. But first, a cool series called Improv Live Comedy Drive-In. KVCR's Lillian Vasquez has more.
My guest is Erin Van Schoenfeld. She is the Vice President of Talent at Levity Entertainment Group, who is working with the Improv in Irvine. Welcome.
Thank you.
So during this coronavirus pandemic, businesses are having to get creative while following the law and doing their best to stay in business and keep their doors open, or in this case, their parking lot. So how is the Irvine Improv keeping comedy alive?
It is providing an excellent live experience on the fourth floor of a parking structure in Irvine, California at the Spectrum. You buy a ticket online and you and your friends get in your car and you drive down to the Spectrum parking lot. You can load into the lot as early as 6 p.m. and then go enjoy the food and beverage of the Spectrum restaurants. There's tons of them. And then just come back by 7:30 for an 8 o'clock show. You and your friends will enjoy it from the inside of your car and tune into the FM dial. The comedian will be on a stage in front of a giant screen and will be projected on the screen and will be coming to you live through the radio.
So this is really unique. So the comedian is actually going to be there. So he or she is there and you're just watching it on the big screen, but you're watching it from your car.
Right. It's a completely live experience. It's only going to happen in that moment. It's not being streamed anywhere. It is just for you and all of the guests that are on the top floor of the parking structure.
Well, very cool. Let's talk about the rules and the guidelines that the guests need to follow or be aware of.
It's pretty simple. We want you to show up and have a good time, but also remember to bring a mask anytime you are not in your vehicle. We'd like you to be wearing that mask if you're going to go to the Spectrum, to the restaurants, to the restroom, anytime you're not in your vehicle. Always practice social distancing. No outside alcohol, no drugs, you know, the standards.
Okay.
But mostly we just want you to show up and have a great time.
Absolutely. Now, one thing that I think is kind of cool about this, it's kind of very old school, and I'm aging myself right here, but guests need to be aware the way to hear the performance is by using the old-fashioned radio, right? So you need to have a radio in your car.
You definitely need to have a radio in your car so that you can tune into the show. Yeah, it's interesting, right? Like, I haven't done that in a really long time. Also aging myself.
Okay. So I guess when they get there, they'll be given a number that they need to go to the radio and tune into that station or that call number.
Absolutely. They're going to give you the FM dial-in and you're going to dial in and listen to the show.
So I know it's early in the project, but how do you think it's being received?
I am absolutely delighted at how it's being received. I was very nervous in the beginning just because it's something absolutely brand new that we hadn't tried before. We put it on sale and boy, selling out that first show, it really does feel like Orange County was ready to come out and see some live comedy. And that is just thrilling for us.
Yeah, I think everybody's ready to go do something somewhere. And the fact that you guys are providing this opportunity is really good. Where can listeners go for tickets and for more information?
Well, you can go to our website, improv.com. It has a full schedule of events, including all the details for the upcoming drive-in, including the cost, the arrival time, additional safety guidelines.
So all the information is right there on the website. Now, let's talk about the cost. What is the cost to see the show?
It is super reasonable. It's $125 per vehicle, and you can fit as many people in the vehicle as there are seatbelts.
Oh, as there are seatbelts. So there is some guidelines. Okay. So if you bring a big vehicle.
No clown cars. Yeah.
So if you bring a big Suburban and you have 9 seatbelts, you can fit 9 people for $125.
Absolutely.
Perfect. Are there plans for doing something like this at other locations?
Based on the success of what's happening in Irvine, we are absolutely looking at other locations in the Southern California area. Keep checking our website for updates, and we can't wait to bring it to your city.
And because we're here in the Inland Empire, is the Ontario Improv one of the properties that might be considered?
Oh, absolutely. Ontario is one of our strongest markets, and we definitely want to bring this to the area. So keep checking back, and I promise pretty soon we'll have something for you.
Perfect. All right. Well, Erin, thank you so much for your time. Looking forward to checking this out and seeing how it works.
Thank you so much.
My guest now is Maz Jobrani. He's one of the comedians scheduled to perform at the Irvine Improv Drive-In Style on September 5th. Maz has also been a panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate you having me on.
So what do you think of this drive-in style of comedy?
Oh, God, it's interesting. You know, in all honesty, I think I've been to a drive-in movie once in my life when I was a kid. And I remember being all excited about it and getting there. And they give you the speaker and you put it in your window. And we were in the back watching. And it was kind of cool. Now, the difference between a drive-in movie and a drive-in stand-up show is stand-up comedians, we need to hear your laughter. So from what I understand, you guys will hear us because there's going to be probably a radio station or some station that you tune into and you listen to. I'm just hoping we can hear you. And as long as we can hear you, it'll be fun. And I am excited because I'll tell you, the last time that I really performed in front of an audience, because I've been doing a lot of Zoom shows, but the last time I performed in front of an actual audience was March 12th. So
Wow. This
will be my first time in front of a live audience. I actually got a chance to do one small set at the Comedy Store a little while back, but in front of a window. Like there was a window between me and a handful of people outside on a patio. But this will be like in front of a big group. So yeah, all that to say, I'm really excited.
Last fall, I had my first taste of comedy. I did a 5-minute stand-up at the Ontario Improv before Alonzo Bowden came on, and the audience feedback was so crucial. I wouldn't have known where to go if there wasn't laughter to keep going or, you know, how to pivot. With this drive-in style format, just like you said, you know, laughter is so important, and how will you adjust if you can't hear? You just keep going and hope they like it?
I think we'll hear at least the first few cars, or we'll see their faces at least. And the truth is, look, I'm a comedian. Anyone who's seen me perform knows that I talk to the audience a lot as well. I go into a bit, and then I go to the audience, and I go to the bit, and then go to the audience. So I suppose I'll be going to the audience and doing silly things like, you know, honk once if you like that joke, honk twice if you didn't, or whatever. My only hope is that I don't offend somebody and have them drive away. That would be... I've had people walk out on me. I've never had anyone drive out on me. That would be kind of interesting.
That would be turn their lights on.
Leaving.
We'll have to ask them to keep their lights turned off as they're driving away so they don't disrupt the others, I guess. I don't know. That it's just so different. What are you talking about these days? The last time we talked, you mentioned your children was part of your act. What are you talking about these days?
Gosh, you know, children still play into that. People ask me, what are you taking on in your comedy? I go, I'm taking on politics, social issues, and my kids. Now, the political side, obviously, more than ever now, we're all so divided, but there's so much going on every day. Every time I refresh my Twitter feed, there's something new. I mean, now they're attacking the U.S. Postal Service. Why would you go after the U.S. Postal Service? And the idea of, like, not wanting people to vote by mail, but then Trump goes and registers himself to vote by mail in Florida. I mean, it's just so much hypocrisy and so much to talk about that I will be definitely talking about the politics of the world. I'll be talking about these people who don't want to wear masks and how ridiculous it is. I'll be talking about my kids and being home under the lockdown. I'll be talking about the feelings we all have with now, you know, touching surfaces and bumping into people or shaking hands. Like, I've stopped shaking hands, obviously. We all have. And it's like, now it's only the namaste, you know, the hands to the chin and the bow.
Oh.
And so there's a lot to talk about. I mean, it's nonstop. I don't know about you. I'm busier than I've ever been because now, as someone who is on lockdown with my family, I'm not just a comedian and a dad, but I'm comedian, I'm dad, I'm the IT person. Whenever the computer's not working, I got to go help people fix their computers. I wash the dishes. I am helping with the cooking. I am fixing toilets. I've become a handyman. The house is breaking because we're all in it. I mean, it's nonstop. So there's a lot to talk about.
Same thing that's going on in your house is going on in everyone's home. I want to ask, as a comedian, how has your line of work changed, stopped, been altered during this pandemic? You said you're keeping busy.
Well, you know, it's funny. Somebody else said this. There were comedians that said, you know, I'm busier than ever, but I just got to figure out how to make money doing it. So that's one of the big changes right now, because there was a time just earlier this year or last year where we could tour and make a living touring. You know, our livelihood was there. And whether you got TV work or not, you still were able to work. But now, because live shows are over, we're at home doing our shows. So, like I said, I was hesitant at first to do any Zoom shows, but then I did a couple, and they were actually kind of fun, because the same way we were just talking about how you need a crowd.
Yeah.
In the Zoom shows, you actually have a crowd. They're there. You see them, and you see people kind of funny. Like, you'll see somebody in their bed. One show I was doing, there was a lady in her bed, like, smoking a cigarette. And I was like, what is she doing? Like, that's a fire hazard, you know? It's been fun, and what you do is you leave the volume on for like a handful of the audience members so you can hear them laugh.
Mm.
So again, it's been fun to continue to perform. I've been doing these shows that I call Moz in the House, which is a talk show that I put up every like 2 to 3 weeks, and we do it on Zoom, and it's fun again. We get to do, it's a talk show, like a regular talk show, but you know, I get your monologue, got my co-host, I got my guest. But the icing is, at the very end, we do something called a master class. It's a master class, but with a M-A-Z. And it's where we invite the audience members to come on to the Zoom and ask us questions about anything, and we give them advice, even though we're not experts in anything. So I'm trying to find ways to stay in the game, to continue to do stuff that interests me, continue to do my podcast, Back to School with Moz Jobrani. I think a lot of comedians are in the same place right now. We're doing cameos. You know, that brings a little bit of money in terms of income. A lot of people are doing Patreon now, where people can sign up to be on your Patreon. It's a crazy time. And we also, by the way, are sensitive to the fact that a lot of people have lost their jobs. So right. A lot of people don't have money to pay for a lot of this stuff. You also then go ahead and put a lot of free content out, whether it's on Instagram or on YouTube or whatever. So finding a balance.
Have you been a guest on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me since the pandemic?
Yeah, I've done 2 Wait, Wait, Don't Tells Me since the pandemic started. Matter of fact, I was on the first one that they did when the pandemic started, and they had Paula and I in studio at NPR West. We were socially distanced, but we were in the same studio, and
okay.
It was right when lockdown was starting to happen. We weren't sure the extent of it, so we still felt like it was okay to be in studio but be distanced. But then after that, they said no more in studio. So everyone's been doing it from their homes. Done 2 from my home as well. And it's an interesting thing. You know, one thing that they tell us, like Peter gives us a reminder before we start. He says, listen, we're going to be, I don't know if you've listened to them, but they have the fake audience laughter,
yes.
That they, the laugh track that they
right.
put on sometimes. But he said, look, as we record, there's obviously not going to be any laughter coming from any audience member. He says, just try to be supportive of each other. If someone says something that's entertaining or funny, try to laugh. So we've been doing that, and it's been fun. The good part of it is that since we're recording from the house, if you mess up or you have a thought that comes up later in the episode, you go, oh, wait, regarding that other segment, I had another thought. They are able to have you go back, and they could edit that back in later. So
well, that's good. That's
there's
good.
Some good things. Yeah.
It's a little
yeah.
different just as the listener listening to it without the laughter. So I like when the other panelists are laughing along so that you kind of are supporting them. It's a whole new world, isn't it?
Listen, it's interesting because you realize how important laughter is to this type of stuff. Because I'll tell you, for me, for example, having done those Zoom shows where I have the handful of audience members laughing, when I hear them laugh, it gives me energy and I get the timing and there's a rhythm to it. Now, the Laugh Factory up here in Hollywood has been doing these afternoon shows. Hold on 1 second. Could you please close the door, Mila? My daughter's here mimicking me.
Okay.
Mila, I'm doing an interview. Please. Thank you. There you go. That's Zoom for you. This is lockdown for you. Lockdown where your 9-year-old walks into your interview and starts making fun of you. But I was saying that I did a show at the Laugh Factory where they were doing afternoon stand-up shows. You perform live, and there's people on YouTube watching, but you don't hear anybody. There's only a handful of people in the actual room, and they weren't, like, really laughing because they were, like, comedians. Like 2 or 3 comedians are in the room. And it was really weird because
yeah.
you lose your rhythm. And so similarly, as an audience member, I think what you said is absolutely right. When you're not hearing the laughter from a stand-up comedy or a comedy show like Wait, Wait, it's a little jolting. You're like, wait, was that funny? Was it not? I'm not sure,
yeah,
you know, blah, blah,
right.
blah. So you're right. I think it's good to have us laugh for each other at least.
Well, Maz, I'm looking forward to your performance on stage at the drive-in style of comedy. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. And whoever's coming, please either laugh really loud so I can hear you from inside your car or just big smiles. I just need to know that you're enjoying it. That's all. And please, like I was saying earlier, if you're leaving, just leave quietly.
Thanks, Maz.
Thank you.
That was KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with comedian Maz Jobrani, coming up September 5th as part of the Improv Live Comedy Drive-In Series. More on that series at improv.com/Irvine. Lillian also spoke with Aaron Von Cernfeldt, Vice President of Talent with Levity Entertainment Group. They run the improv clubs closest to our area in Ontario and in Irvine. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, NPR One, and Google Play. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming, and staying with comedy for the rest of the evening. Later in the program, I'll be speaking with Bobcat Goldthwait. First, though, comedian John Pate, a guest several times on American Parlor Songbook. Here's KVCR's Benjamin Perper.
You're originally from Alabama. Why did you decide to come to California?
For the specific purpose of doing stand-up comedy and acting and writing.
What was the comedy scene in SoCal like in those days?
It was huge at that time. I came in 77, and from that point, from 77 to about 1992, was really the comedy heyday. All of the big places were out here, and whenever you were to watch The Tonight Show or The Merv Griffin Show or The Dinah Shore Show or any of those, they would always have people on the show, the comics, who were performing at the Comedy Store and the Improvisation. And so I saw that back in Alabama, and I would say, and he'll be appearing at the Ice House and the Comedy Store and the Improv. And they would rattle off the dates. And when you hear Merv Griffin or Johnny Carson say that, you go, wow, I want to do that. I want to perform there. So I came with the full intention of being a comic. And first place I walked into, the Comedy Store, they gave us an audition night, and I started going to the audition night, and within about 6 months, I was a regular performer there. And at that time, there weren't that many working or professional performing comics from coast to coast. There were maybe 400 or 500. Now there are probably 15,000 comics in all the different venues and places. But at that time, it was a small class of people, a small group of comics, and I got in a really fortunate time.
Is that place still there, the Comedy Store in Los Angeles?
Comedy Store is on Sunset Boulevard. In fact, if you go and you drive by and you look on the front window, you'll see my name right next to Robin Williams.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice. Baptist Press did a story about you in the 90s, which talked about being a Christian comedian in a field where there weren't too many of those. How did that influence your comedy?
Well, it didn't really affect me one way or the other, because here's an adage that I got from the head of entertainment at the Riviera Hotel when he first hired me. He said, well, this guy, he's a clean comic. How does that go over in the casinos? And the guy said, hey, funny is funny. Pate just happens to be clean and funny. In fact, he even went on to be on the TV show The Sopranos, Steve Sciarippa. And I appreciated that when he said it, but at the same time, I always felt like if you do clean material, you're going to be able to work forever. A lot of the guys, they kind of limit themselves to just working clubs because they can't work on TV, they can't work on family cruise ships, they can't work in different venues. I got a lot of work because I was a clean comic. There were many years that I worked for CBS for the two TV shows, Designing Women and Evening Shade, as their warm-up artist. They had a studio audience there. They would bring their families for the show and their big tourist crowds. So they wanted a clean comic. So it really helped in the long run that you work clean.
Yeah, definitely. One of the people you dedicate your book to, which we'll get to later, is Red Skelton. What was your relationship with Red, and how did he shape your comedy?
Well, that was really one of those things where you land at a point of destiny, because I couldn't have worked it out myself. I really, as a kid, all I wanted to do was meet Red Skelton. Mm-hmm. I thought he was the best, funniest comic and actor and entertainer of all time. And so I worked toward it. I would gear my act toward just kind of mimicking and relating to him and family entertainment. And it just so happened that I was working in Las Vegas, and I was walking over to the Hilton Hotel where they had a Red Skelton gallery, an art gallery with a lot of his artwork. And the owner of the gallery, he said, "Are you a Red Skelton fan?" I said, "Yeah, I'm performing across the street. Do you want to come to the show?" So he came to the show that night, and then after the show was over, he said, "We're doing a show with Red. Would you like to be on the show with him?" And I said, "Are you kidding? All I want to do is meet the guy. Wow, this is great. Yes, of course I'll do it." Mm-hmm. And so I flew back to Las Vegas to do the show with him. Well, he complimented me during the show, and then after the show, he and his wife talked with me for about 15 minutes. And from that point on, from 1991 until 1997, when he passed away, he would always request me to be his opening act. So I thought I was in heaven, you know, just to be able to not only meet the guy, but to be able to work with him for so long.
Yeah, so you got 6 years of basically opening for your mentor. And
the great thing was that I got a lot of lessons from him. I would ask him questions. I would quiz him at the airport or when we were on the plane or riding around somewhere. And he just gave me probably the best advice of anybody that I've ever met.
So you've also worked with the likes of Jay Leno, Robin Williams, as you said, Jerry Seinfeld. Do you have any memorable stories about any of them?
Well, being able to work out on the road with Jay, and again, that this is going to go back to the clink comedy thing. Mm-hmm. Jay would always tell everybody when he first started out that his goal was to be in television. And because of that, he had to keep his act clean. And he hated following a dirty opening act. And when you would work the comedy clubs, you really had no say as to who you worked with until you got to a status like a Jay Leno or a David Letterman or somebody like that. So there were about three or four people that he requested to be his opening act, and I was one of those people. I got to work with him in a lot of places, in San Jose and down in Newport Beach and in Oklahoma City and different places. He would ask for me to be his opening act because he hated following somebody dirty. He felt like if I have to take 15 minutes to work to get the crowd back on my side and make them forget what they just heard, then I've lost 15 minutes of my act. So he just really appreciated the fact that I was a clean comic. And after the shows were over and stuff, even out on the road, there would be club owners that would want Jay to go out with them to a bar or something. And he didn't like to do that. He would kind of use me as an excuse. He would say, me and Pate, we're going to go back to the hotel. We're going to play video games. He just didn't like doing those types of things because he was working toward a goal. And of course, he achieved that goal. It was great. Now, I do have a funny story about working with David Letterman. Mm. We were working out in the San Fernando Valley. And we actually stopped to get dinner at this little burger place. And the guy behind the counter immediately recognized Dave because he had already been on The Tonight Show and stuff. And the guy behind the counter was really nervous about getting his order. And so he pushed the order out in front of Dave and he said, "Mr. Letterman, sorry about this, but we burned your French fries, so we gave you some extra." And Dave turned to me and he said, "Ooh, just what I wanted, more burned French fries." It was one of those things that Dave would later use as a joke in his act, but just little tidbits like that of things that would happen on the road were, it was an experience that I always remember because of these guys that I worked with.
Yeah. Any chance you'll be invited to do Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld?
I doubt it, even though I get to talk to Jerry through different people because he works with a lot of the same guys that I do. And I'll always say, "Oh, tell Jerry I said hi." And even he's my Facebook friend, but I don't ever get any messages from him or anything. I just kind of keep track of what he's been doing and stuff. But I doubt very seriously if I'm going to be on that show anytime soon.
Okay.
You got to have notoriety in somebody that they can recognize, and I'm not to that level.
Okay. Do you still do stand-up comedy these days? You mentioned that.
Still do it in the summertime. I just did a one night. I was at the Rampart Hotel in Las Vegas 2.5 weeks ago. So I'll do that usually once in the summertime and once at Christmas break. But because of my teaching schedule, I don't get to go and do the extended engagements anymore.
Yeah. So aside from a long career as a comedian, actor, writer, etc., you're also a part-time professor at Cal State San Bernardino. How did you find your way into academia?
That was very interesting. Because I was doing the warm-ups for the TV shows, it took me off the road. And the road circuit at the time, during the late 80s and early 90s, there were a lot of clubs in a lot of different places. And when they offered me the job of working with Designing Women in Evening Shade, one filmed on Tuesday night and one filmed on Thursday night. So that kept me in town. But I was only working two nights a week. And it left all of my days free. So I decided to go back to Cal State LA and get my graduate degree. And when I did, I saw two little notices on the job board there. One was for Azusa Pacific University, and one was for Cal State San Bernardino. And I said, well, I'll apply for these and see if I get one of them. Well, I got both. And the great thing was that I just kind of traded one audience for another audience, an academic audience for an entertainment audience. And so I started teaching part-time and was able to convey the same communication techniques and skills and stage presence and those types of things that you have to have. And it really tied in well with communication aspects, so I really enjoyed it. And so I just kept doing it. After the run of the TV shows, when the shows were at the end of their run, I couldn't go back out on the road that much anymore because a lot of the comedy clubs in the mid-90s started to dry up. Television was saturated with comedy, and as a result, there wasn't really that trendy nature of comics at comedy clubs anymore. Even though I still go and do concerts in Las Vegas in the summertime and things, I don't really do comedy clubs anymore. So I just enjoy that from August until June doing the academic stuff.
Yeah. So speaking of academics, I found this video online of a song you recorded called "One Day When You Sing That," "One Day When You Swing That Skillet," and most of the comments are something along the lines of "That's my comm teacher," or "That's my professor at San Bernardino." Do you show that video in class often?
No, I don't. But when students hear that I'm a comic, they'll immediately go and search my name on YouTube, and that video will pop up there. That song. Not only does it haunt me, but it in the sense that it was a great song. Yeah. It was a country song, and I was doing it as a joke in my act, and I was performing down in Nashville one time. Just the song title, "One Day When You Swing That Skillet, My Face Ain't Gonna Be There," was a punchline for a joke. So I did it on stage, and then after the show was over, this guy comes up to me, and he hands me his card, and he says, I'm Mike Borchetta, Borchetta Music, here in Nashville. Do you actually have a song by that title? And I just kind of looked around. And I said, yeah, I do. So I came back to California, and I wrote the song, and a friend of mine did all the music on the song. He plays 12 instruments. He's a genius musician. His name is John Jorgensen, but he's an incredible guitarist, but he plays a lot of other instruments. So we put the song out with he, myself, and another friend of mine, Dick Hardwick, and the song ended up having a better career than I did at the time because it started getting a lot of airplay and sold a lot of copies of just, this was back when we had vinyl, mm-hmm. sold a lot of copies of the album and the single. And then somebody got the bright idea to make the video back in 1985 when MTV was in its infancy at the time. So even though the quality is one of those really old music videos, it still haunts me because the kids found it on YouTube.
Yeah, definitely. And that's you singing in it, right?
Oh,
that's your voice?
Yeah, that's me singing it.
Nice. Yeah, great. By the way, you have a 4.4 on Rate My Professor, which is pretty good.
Oh, well, so even better. I don't go to see it. I don't read the comments or anything. But if Rate My Professor says so, then I'm happy about it.
Yeah, no, so it's it's serving you well still.
Well, everybody knows I love my wife. She's as sweet as she can be. Oh, but she's got a knack for getting her way that don't feel so good to me. Well, honey, I'm tired and I can't take no more. I'm black and blue and my head is sore. Things go dark and I hit the floor, and you don't feel sorry for me.
One day when you swing that skillet, my face ain't gonna be there. One day when you throw that rolling pin, it ain't gonna part my hair.
Well, you can throw a tantrum, throw a fit, or when you throw that toaster, it's time to quit.
That was KVCR's Benjamin Perper in conversation with comedian John Pate. Pate's been on American Parlor Songbook perhaps a half dozen times. You can hear American Parlor Songbook Sunday afternoons at 4 on KVCR and more at Facebook/American Parlor Songbook, also at npr.org/podcasts and at kvcrnews.org/programs. Then just look for American Parlor Songbook. More on John Pate at patecomedy.com. It's been comedy and how to see it for the entirety of tonight's KVC Arts. Rounding out the program now, Bobcat Goldthwait. This is actually from a few years ago when he was set to perform at Ace's Comedy Club in Murrieta, and his documentary, Call Me Lucky, was new.
Hey, this is Bobcat. How are you?
Hey, you're doing great, Bobcat. How about you today?
I'm okie doke.
I'm glad I'm not the only one that uses that phrase. I always get a spell check whenever I try to type it, though.
What does it correct it to?
It doesn't correct it. It just tells me I'm wrong every way that I possibly try it. It's
You're just wrong.
I go about the rest of my day feeling wrong.
Yeah, it ruins it. It crushes the dokeness out.
Okay, that's a keeper, too. Now, with some of the awards, I noticed Best Documentary. Tell us about Call Me Lucky. What kind of publicity are you doing right now?
I've been on the road with it at film festivals since Sundance in February. It's a documentary about my friend Barry Crimmins, and it's a lot heavier than I think people would imagine me making a movie about. But he's a comedian, and he was a mentor to people like myself and Patton Oswalt, or people that he influenced like David Cross. And he's got a lot of fans, Margaret Cho. And he's not so well-known Boston comedian who started this comedy club that a lot of people came from. But Barry, as an adult, was processing. He was a victim of rape when he was a child, when he was four. And this was in the 90s when he was looking for other survivors. And he found on AOL that they were allowing child pornography to be exchanged. They didn't do anything about it when he complained about it. So Barry ended up taking AOL all the way to the floor of the Senate and embarrassing them about their policies.
Oh,
and
gosh.
People are now like, oh, well, what's the big deal? But like AOL was the only game in town, basically, when he went on the Internet. So
wow.
It was a very Capra-esque story, this one guy, this outsider, going into Washington and taking on a big company or the system. So that's why I made the movie. Besides that, I love the guy.
And it talks about him being the personification of the healing power of comedy. Just a brief statement, but rather powerful.
Yeah, game. And I believe so. I believe that is Barry, because you see this guy at the beginning of the movie, and I was fortunate enough to have footage and things of him, where he's just full of anger towards the world, himself, just an anger ball, but very loved, but still this really rageful guy. And then by the end, and he comes through the other side of this, he turns that anger and he aims it at specific targets that probably warrant some change or some magnification. And in the process, you know, I watched the change in Barry where he became open, where he always had friends, but able to help himself and other people. So it's a very uplifting story, even though the topic seems so dark.
Yeah, it does. As you mentioned, it seems heavier than one might expect, but it sounds like something very fascinating. And it is in theaters right now. And simply put, a person can go to callmeluckymovie.com and find out more about it there. I really also want to hear about Willow Creek. I didn't know about Willow Creek, a movie about Bigfoot, found footage horror.
I was just wondering, can I scare people? Can I make a suspenseful movie? So I made a found footage movie about Bigfoot, and even I, as a moviegoer, I'm kind of over found footage.
Yeah.
Because I always figure, who found this footage and then edited it into a movie? Who said, well, I'm sorry your family died, but I really think there's a tremendous picture here if we recut it. So I just felt the story lended itself to, you know, this naive couple going into the woods. Pretty classic stuff, but that was the challenge, and people liked it, and the Bigfoot community liked it. You know, I think people thought I was going to come in and be making fun of them.
Right.
But they're pretty put upon people, you know. They're not a group of people that, you know, it's funny. It's like you say, oh, I believe in Bigfoot. I immediately think you have this person figured out in their entirety.
Right,
so
right.
I wanted to use the same kind of kindness I would use on other subjects that I would use with these folks. So I'm happy that they like it. It was a really fun movie to make, you know, going out in the woods, you know, looking for Bigfoot. You know, the worst day looking for Bigfoot means you just went camping. So yeah. It was pretty fun making the
right.
movie.
There's a beautiful quote in there. I think one of the principals there mentions the curse of Bigfoot, and that is if you believe in it, you're going to spend the rest of your time either alone or looking for something you're never going to find.
You're probably going to end up losing your friends and family, too, along the way. So,
right.
Yeah, that's the curse of Bigfoot. You know, I've actually spoke with Bigfoot researchers who've actually said that to me, that they hope they never find Bigfoot in a weird way. You know, initially, I was going to make a movie about faith and set it in the Bigfoot community. But when I got up to Willow Creek, I was like, oh, this town just lends itself to making a horror picture. And I always wondered if I could make a horror picture. You know, a suspenseful film, not a gore film. I mean, I don't have a problem with gory movies, and maybe someday I'll make one. But it's a good Halloween movie. There's a couple scares in it. People seem to like it.
And I'll tell you what, I've only seen the trailer for this just a few minutes back, and I really want to just skip the rest of my day and go and watch it. And you also had interviews with the local townspeople from Willow. And this is, I mean, they've been living Bigfoot since, what, 67 or so?
Yeah, and even before them, but 67 is when the Patterson and Gimlin footage was shot. So, yeah, it's a weird hybrid of actual people and then some actors. And some of the town's folks, I didn't necessarily say, hey, you're in the middle of a horror picture. the actors would just interview them in character. I think it helps, hopefully, make the films feel a little bit more realistic. You know, I think the problem in a lot of scary movies is you don't empathize with the characters before terrible, scary things happen to them. And I think that shift happened somewhere in the 70s and 80s, where I believe subconsciously we're really kind of rooting for the monsters in a lot of the horror pictures.
Sure.
And I wanted to get back to making a monster that was mysterious and just scary.
That's one of the greatest things about this, from what little I've seen, is much like Jaws, you don't actually see the monster as much as you have references to it, and that's scarier than actually seeing it. So,
yeah, I always feel that our imagination is way scarier. And those moments when you do show stuff, you have to give the audience something that they didn't expect. So that, there's some twists and turns in Willow Creek.
One more thing on that. Who was responsible for the poster design on Willow Creek? Just truly incredible.
Oh, that's my friend Alex Pardee. He did such a great job.
Is that what he does for a living?
Yeah, he's an artist. He's got a lot of stuff. But yeah, he did it, and he did such a good job, I went and had it tattooed on my arm.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I have Bigfoot tattooed on my arm.
Excellent. All right. Okay, a couple more directorial things. I read that while you were directing the Jimmy Kimmel Show, I had no idea there that ratings apparently soared. Just soared on that. Now, without going into negativity of the previous, what were you doing that was different at that point that got so many more viewers and into the teen audience, too?
Well, ratings did go up, but I don't know if I can necessarily take credit for that. I think Jimmy was finding his balance.
Gotcha.
Maybe I helped facilitate him to be himself, make it easier. That's the thing I try to do as a director, is to, even if it's something I don't create, is to make the folks in front of the camera feel safe. That's the whole thing, so some directors I can force a performance out of people, but if you make it an environment where people feel they can be themselves or be as creative as they can be, it just makes me look good. So
okay.
I do it for total selfish reasons.
Beautiful. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Bobcat Goldthwaite. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, NPR One, Spotify, and Google Play. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. This is an NPR station, so I've got some things about Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me coming up. But
okay.
I have to ask you about the comedy. There's a mention of a debut when you were 20 on David Letterman, but I think you were actually performing even in high school. Would you count these as early professional gigs?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, I was doing stand-up when I was a teenager and started getting paid a little bit from Barry Kermans, the subject of Call Me Lucky. That's how I met him. My friend Tom Kenny, who's the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants and a bunch of other cartoons, we've known each other since we were in first grade. We saw an ad looking for comedians when we were in high school at this local club, and that was Barry Crimmins. And he didn't know that we were high schoolers. He was expecting a couple of men to come in the bar.
Oh, wonderful.
And still put us on stage, probably because they didn't have a lot of comedians. And that's what gave both Tom and I our actual launch into professional show business.
Oh, beautiful. Wow.
It's a word I usually try to run away from when I hear the word professional.
Well, one of my favorite specials out there with you pretty much has it opening with you apologizing for not having any jokes. And truly, your performance is really just observations, not jokes. And much the same in the recent You Don't Look the Same Either with Showtime. And so when you're on stage, it truly seems to be you reflecting on what's going on. Do you have noted observations that you bring to the stage, or is it truly that spontaneous?
It's a good mixture of what's going on with me today and then material I have. And almost I feel like my job as a comedian is I feel a little bit sometimes like I'm a wedding band. And I'm like, you know what? I think I should do Proud Mary right now. I really think we need to get these people dancing. I think we should do I Like Big Butts right now. So it's kind of a mixture of the feedback from the audience. And then I always like to, on a given day, like when I know I'm going to do a show, to make a few mental notes to force myself to talk about something new. Mostly not for the audience's benefit, but just for myself, so it keeps it interesting.
Gotcha. Going back a long way, some of the specials have you really just forgetting what's going on for a second, and then, Oliver North, and then going into that business for a bit.
Yeah, and that's infuriating to some people where I'm interrupting myself.
Ah.
But when I'm doing that, that really means I am in the zone. Those moments I really like when, you know, I'm completely off script in a place. You know, it's funny, I did 3 shows in New York Saturday night a few weeks ago, and I was like, oh, this 3rd show is going to be a nightmare. But it ended up being a show that was about 80% improv, new stories and stuff, and that was really fun.
Okay, one more thing on that. In You Don't Look the Same Either, you do reference balding, saying, what am I going to do, wear a bandana all the time like Bret Michaels? I truly lost my coffee on that one. Did you ever get any blowback on that? Bret ever call you? The rest of the Poison
Gang?
No, I've
never heard from him. And usually you do hear from people. But, you know, it's kind of strange to be 53, you know, and have a reputation for being kind of almost like a rock kind of comedian.
Sure.
And then looking the way I look now, and you know, when I see some of these rock stars and they're wearing extensions and
mascara
and girdles, you know, I'm like, hey, this is what a guy my age looks like. And I know it's jarring for people too often, because they've only seen me in movies or they haven't seen me in a long time, and then they see me now and they're like, is that Bobcat's dad?
They're expecting the high nervous energy thing that they got in the first several Police Academy, or, you know, who knows what.
Sure, but, yeah. Sure. I understand that, you know, so I diffused that a little bit. And I understand that, the expectations, and if you're a fan of that, and then you come to see me. But I feel pretty confidently here. For the most part, I think I do leave the people that had those expectations gravely disappointed. No, I think I do leave those people hopefully entertained.
A couple of things in the public radio world. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I know that you came on initially to talk about God Bless America, and you ended up winning at the Not My Job. How did this gig come about for you? Is this a friend of a friend? Is this an agent thing?
No, it was really funny. After I called in the show and did that, they asked me if I would come on as a guest, and I'm really excited. I just kind of booked a whole bunch for next year. I was really busy with Call Me Lucky, so I didn't get to do the show as much as I like to. But it's really fun to do. The recording of it goes really fast, and it's just, I would have never guessed that I would have become an NPR staple later on in life, but it's one of the most fun things that I get to do.
Are you a public radio listener yourself?
Yeah, here in Los Angeles, sure. I do listen to public radio. And then occasionally I'll listen to some conservative talk just to make my head explode.
Oh, sure. That's fuel for the fire.
I don't get so upset. I'm more fascinated, you know. And it's really scary when I'm in the rest of the country traveling around where that's people's only diet, you know.
Oh, sure.
It's really strange. And what's really strange is the phenomenon of FM rock stations that are very conservative. You know, it's really weird how that happened.
Yeah, almost antithetical.
That's really strange.
Yeah. Well, I guess if you're going to the conservative talk, it's, I suppose, nice to come back to NPR when you can then.
It's a mental sorbet, I guess.
Excellent.
It's a palate cleanser.
I noticed we're a little bit past the time that we said, I guess I want to say one thing about Robin Williams, and that is that we lost an entertainer, but I know that you lost a friend, so I am sorry for your loss in that regard. And I didn't want to go into Robin at all, but I did want to at least say that to you, because I know it's different. It's a different world.
Well, thanks. And it is strange. You know, I do think of my friend every day, and I miss him. And I appreciate the kindness, you know, and I understand he meant so much to so many people. But it's been a little odd this year trying to process this. And, you know, he actually had a lot to do with Call Me Lucky getting made. He was a fan of Barry's and knew Barry's story, and he suggested that I make it as a documentary and actually gave me the initial money that started the filming. So I wouldn't have made the movie if it wasn't for him. And then he passed away, and then I'm like, oh, what am I going to do? And I felt, well, I'm pretty sure he would have wanted me to finish the movie. So that's how I got through it. And then it was very strange this year to come out of it and still have my pal, this guy. You know, I have a lot of friends, but I didn't have a friend that I actually heard from and kept in better touch with than him. So it's been strange. I'll say this about Robin. Robin was truly the most generous person I've ever met, and not just with charity and giving people money or supporting people. But if you met him, he would listen to you, and not only would he make you laugh, he would laugh at stuff you had to say. He was very infectious. And I feel like this year I've been shown a lot of kindness from a lot of people, and I like to think that that's the last gift my generous friend gave me.
Oh, beautiful.
So we can end on a positive note.
Yes. You know what? I just came across something else that maybe may lift you up and give you a smile. looking for stuff on this interview, one of my coworkers just typed in Bobcat Goldthwait plus Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And about the third hit, there's some independent guy. He's not connected to the show or anybody. He's got you listed the scoring breakdown for Bobcat Goldthwait, how many times you scored 4 times, how many times you scored 1 time, the average over your various appearances. It seems you average getting third place, but your most recent appearance has you at second, so you tied for second.
Yeah, I'm coming up. It's funny. It's the better you get at the game, though, I've noticed, it's not as entertaining. It's kind of funnier to listen to Paula or me not do well. But my ego kicks in, and now I've been working on a little bit better of boning up on press and stuff.
Excellent.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bobcat. Appreciate your time.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Bobcat Goldthwait in an interview from a few years ago when he was set to perform at Ace's Comedy Club in Murrieta. With that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to Bobcat Goldthwait, along with John Pate, Maz Jobrani, and Aaron Von Cernfeld, Vice President of Talent with Levity Entertainment Group. Here at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Lillian Vasquez, Benjamin Perper, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so as always, thanks to Sean as well. You can hear many past shows through iTunes, NPR One, Spotify, and Google Play. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Just go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.